Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, March 25th. Here is the New York backdrop against which Mayor Adams lifted the workplace vaccine mandate for professional athletes and other performers yesterday. Over the last 2 weeks, according to the New York Times COVID tracker, the number of new COVID cases per day in New York State has gone up by 44%. Thank you, Omicron variant BA2. The number of new cases among New York City public school students has doubled compared to a month ago, according to the education news website Chalkbeat and its crunching of the data. We'll see if the new spike in cases produces a new spike in serious cases and deaths. But for the moment, the news about serious disease is very good around here. The Times COVID tracker says the number of people hospitalized with COVID is now 30% less than it was 2 weeks ago in New York State. ICU beds in use for COVID patients also down 30% compared to 2 weeks ago. And the number of people dying from it is 50% less than 2 weeks ago. Just 10 people died statewide from COVID yesterday, according to the Times tracker. At the peak of Omicron in January, more than 200 New Yorkers were dying per day. Also right now, Pfizer and Moderna are seeking government approval for fourth vaccine doses for people. Germany's health minister today called for fourth doses for all people over 70 in that country with underlying conditions. At the other end of life, Moderna has now released clinical trial results for children as young as 6 months old. So there is a lot to talk about. And we'll get a bi-coastal view, as joining me now is Dr. Monica Gandhi, MD, and with a master's in public health to boot, an infectious diseases specialist and professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. San Francisco has been a national leader in policies to fight COVID throughout the pandemic, as I think we can say has been New York. Dr. Gandhi, before you've even said a word, you've gone above and beyond for us doing this segment at 7 in the morning Pacific time. So thank you and welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
And let me start with the big new controversy in New York City and get your San Francisco take. New York City has a vaccine requirement for all employees who go to work in person at any workplace, private sector included. Here is a clip of what Mayor Adams said to a heckler just a few weeks ago when the heckler said, "Lift the vaccine mandate on Kyrie Irving, the unvaccinated star of the Brooklyn Nets." Listen.
Brother, thank you. Thank you very much. And you're right, sir. You're right. And you're right. Thank you. Listen, you're right. Kyrie can play tomorrow. Get vaccinated.
Kyrie can play tomorrow. Get vaccinated. But that was then. Yesterday, he lifted that vaccine mandate just for professional athletes and performers. This had a lot to do with Kyrie Irving and his Nets approaching the playoffs and baseball season coming. Other unvaccinated people, however, who've been fired from their jobs for not being vaccinated, including 1,400 municipal workers, are understandably furious at the double standard. The New York Times reports this morning that the executives from these wealthy New York sports franchises lobbied the mayor hard for the win he gave them yesterday. The owner of the Mets contributed to a political action committee tied to Adams. So, Dr. Gandhi, my question to you is about the underlying policy. New York is the only city in the country, as far as I know, to have a private sector vaccine mandate at all. And I wonder, has that ever been considered in San Francisco or elsewhere in the U.S. that you know of?
Well, so San Francisco did have vaccine passports and vaccine mandates for healthcare workers, and then some private employers chose to do vaccine mandates. At this point in time, however,
but those were some private employers doing it on their own. I just want to make that distinction.
That's really fair. And then actually, at the beginning, San Francisco did have city employees. It was actually the first place, along with New York, that had city employees have to have a vaccine mandate. So it is true that New York and San Francisco paralleled each other in that way. One issue, though, is that at this point in the pandemic, and I just wrote a piece in Smirnikosh CNN about this, we have to decide what's divisive and what's not divisive and what makes sense. And the arbitrariness of some of our rules, where wealthy people can get out of a rule and poor people can't get out of a rule, where children are, I believe, in New York, cannot get into museums without showing their vaccine card, and a member of a sports team can. This kind of arbitrary aspect of our COVID policies are creating divisiveness. And what I really think needs to happen at this point is that we have the vaccines. We've had them for more than a year. We know that they're amazing at preventing severe disease, but they don't actually block all transmission. And that's just a function of essentially our antibodies coming down, the new variants, and mandates are increasingly being dropped in multiple municipalities. And it makes sense to me to heal the divisiveness and not have mandates for either masks or vaccines at this point, but essentially, you know, strongly recommend, can even have testing if people don't want to get vaccinated. But this is getting profoundly divisive, and I've been watching what's going on in New York.
Well, you're saying it's time to lift all vaccine and mask mandates on anyone. Do I hear you correctly?
So I wrote this piece that essentially said, what are the two biggest policies that are creating divisiveness? I actually didn't say vaccine mandates in the piece. I said vaccine passports and mask mandates, because what's happened with mask mandates is that there's been half the country has been doing this for a year and half the country's been doing something else. And so when the CDC put in their new mask guidance on February 24th, to me, it made sense because they actually said, we recommend masking. The city of San Francisco is recommending masking, but it becomes a personal choice. And going back to vaccines, the point of vaccines were to prevent severe disease. And at this point in the pandemic, there are people who we can't seem to encourage enough to get the vaccine. And so there are other ways to say, okay, you need to get tested, you need to do maybe wear a mask at work. But the firing of people because of not getting vaccinated, I have found a very harsh punishment.
Well, it's certainly divisive, but has it protected public health? It was just a few weeks ago that 2,000 Americans every day were dying of COVID in the Omicron wave. Now it's down to about 800 Americans every day. That's still an unbelievable toll if you spread it out over the year at this current what's considered a low rate. So do we just pull the foot off the gas pedal of protecting public health because it's politically divisive?
No, not at all. I am essentially saying that there are other ways to enforce vaccination requirements, which are if you're not going to get vaccinated, then you'll test, you'll mask, you'll do something else. We absolutely have to encourage vaccinations. And in fact, it is New York City's high rate of vaccination, San Francisco's high rate of vaccination. And increasingly, if you look at other countries beyond us, anyone who has an 80% rate of vaccination or above has weathered Omicron so much better than we did in different places, Delta better than we did. It was an incredibly important technique at the beginning of the pandemic. But at this point, if people will not get vaccinated, there are other ways to enforce ways for people to be safe around them, right, like testing and masking. Mm-hmm. But firing, I think,
and the test or vaccine mandate. But the testing mandate was the first thing that went away, right? The original version of it in New York was you have to show, if you're going to enter a restaurant or some other public place, you either have to show proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test within the last day or within the last 3 days. The testing requirement as an alternative was the first thing to fall away. That's because Mayor de Blasio wanted to focus on forcing everybody, incentivizing everybody to get vaccinated, because that's the longer term strategy against COVID. So the testing alternative has already gone away here, as I think almost everywhere. You're saying that could come back?
So here in San Francisco, we have also dropped vaccine passports, but vaccine mandates have not been dropped. And anyone who
What's the difference?
The difference is this. So you can go into a restaurant here and not show proof of vaccination. And that's a recent change in the last 3 weeks. But if you go to work, again, city employees have to be vaccinated. And if you go to work and you've chosen not to be vaccinated, you have to test and mask. So it's vaccine mandates with testing.
So what do you make of the number so far from Omicron BA2? And by way of background, I mentioned some of this in the introduction. We're seeing cases go up at a high rate, but from a very low starting point. We're not seeing deaths or hospitalizations increase yet, which is really the test. But this keeps being in the news. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki announced this week she has COVID. So did Hillary Clinton. And Barack Obama just recently, too. These are Democrats who believe COVID is real and don't carry ivermectin with them. The Prime Minister of Ireland got it in D.C. last week after meeting briefly with Biden. The president has tested negative, but it's circling him. And I'm raising these public figure examples, Doctor, only to say the pandemic is not over and a new wave is upon us. We saw hospitalizations and deaths spike again with Omicron 1, even though that was said to be less severe on average. There were so many cases. What's the policy response and how quickly to Omicron 2, in your opinion?
So what the CDC has decided and multiple countries are deciding is to act on severe disease, hospitalizations and deaths, because unfortunately, cases are going to be always with us. And I think that's an extremely hard pill to swallow that we can't eradicate COVID-19, but it really isn't the public's fault. There's 29 animals, species of animals that carry COVID. It is our immunity is not completely sterilizing as we just discussed, and it has a long infectious period. It looks like other viruses. And so cases will be among us. What we have to do is keep on vaccinating our population, keeping our population immune, so that our hospitalizations stay low. South Korea has a 90% vaccination rate, and they are seeing high BA1 cases, but their hospitalizations are staying low. Hong Kong, high BA1 cases, do not have that good vaccination rate, and unfortunately is leading to hospitalizations and deaths. Huh. So it is now going to be—
But you're just making a case for a vaccine mandate, right? How are we going to get everybody vaccinated and keep from overwhelming the hospitals again if we don't keep these mandates in place?
So the vaccine mandate, again, I live in a city where everyone's mandated to be vaccinated, but we didn't fire people. We allowed them to be tested and masked. And what you are hitting up against is that there has been misinformation about these vaccines. People truly have been confused. They actually think they're dangerous. And I'm not saying I wish that had never happened, but that's what happened. And I think our only point of disagreement that you and I are having is if someone should be fired or not. So I think we have to, again, in our city, we didn't fire people. We allowed them to have other ways to exist at work and keep people safe. So going back to BA2, there's no doubt that we are going to see case increases. And in places that were highly vaccinated, you're absolutely right. What you just said is absolutely right. That's where the severe disease stays low.
In that case, let's move on to boosters. You wrote an article on who should get a second booster dose, and we see Pfizer and Moderna applying for approval to administer them. We see Germany's health minister just this morning recommending second boosters for anyone over 70 with certain underlying conditions. I don't know if he specified which, but who needs one in your opinion?
So this speaks to how complex our immune system is, because essentially what happens is that we create antibodies from a booster and they go up nice and high, but they will unfortunately come down after about 4 months. That's what was shown with the third booster. But luckily we have baseline cells, which are called T cells and B cells from our vaccines, that can produce more antibodies if we see the virus again. There are certain populations who they're fine just with their T cells and B cells producing more antibodies, taking their time. But there are certain populations that need their boosting to occur because their antibodies should stay high at all times. And those are the patients that are at risk for severe breakthroughs. A large CDC study showed that those who are immunocompromised or those who are over 75 with four comorbidities we're at risk for severe breakthroughs without a booster. So we should be thinking about boosting older populations. Germany has decided on 70, I believe. UK's decided on 75. Sweden's decided on 70. And Pfizer has applied for an over 65-year-old indication, not all populations. Usually older people are more at risk for severe breakthroughs, and people are immunocompromised who are already accepted and approved for the fourth dose.
You're saying over 75, over 70 in some of the European countries with multiple comorbidities. I think you also just said Pfizer is applying for approval for people over 65 in this country just based on age. Where
right.
should that,
it's likely to
where in your opinion, in your medical opinion, where should that line be? We have a lot of listeners who are over 65 and pretty healthy, who will run right out tomorrow and get a fourth dose if it's authorized. Should they?
Well, in our system, no one's applying based on comorbidities, and it's probably you also have to simplify the world, just like the UK and Germany and Sweden are simplifying the world, and it's likely to just be an age cutoff, and anyone over 65 is likely to going to be able to get it after the FDA puts in their ruling on April 6th. And it'll take about 3 weeks to go through the CDC. It's simplicity is best. So something like an older population or those who are immunocompromised are likely to be approved for this vaccine for the fourth dose.
And then I guess it's up to each individual. Take me one step deeper about how the booster protection wanes. You said wanes after about 4 months. I think a lot of our listeners have heard that timeline before. But I think you're saying it's the protection against getting infected at all that wanes. The protection against serious disease lasts much longer than 4 months. Do we know that?
Yes, we really do know that. So that's why I'm concerned when people use the word immunity wanes, because it's very non-nuanced. Antibodies wane, which are one part of the immune system, but not T cells, not B cells. This is what's called cellular immunity, and they look like they're lasting a long time. For example, there was a large CDC study just a couple of days ago that showed during Omicron, even two doses protected the majority of people in this country from severe disease. So why? Because T cells protect you against severe disease, and then the B cells are aided by the T cells to produce more antibodies. What is waning for most of us is the ability to protect ourselves from mild disease, which is our first line of defense is antibodies in the nasal cavity. And the way to prevent all of us from getting mild disease would be to boost the entire population every 4 months. That isn't very logistically feasible. It isn't realistic. And beyond that, I think we have to get away from the concept that vaccines prevent all infection. It's related to a lot of what we talked about earlier in the program. They really are there to protect us against severe disease, the most dastardly thing that can happen with COVID.
Before we run out of time, let me tick off two other things in the news real quickly. One, you tweeted about the Moderna trial on kids as young as 6 months old. How would you describe the results and what would you recommend?
Well, so it was interesting because essentially the Moderna dose for little children, 6 months to just under six, was 25 micrograms given 28 days apart. That is actually much higher of a dose than Pfizer, which didn't really work very well for the 2 to 4 year olds. So Pfizer's on hold right now for little kids. Okay, so going back to Moderna, it did work in terms of its primary outcome, raising antibodies to protect people. Because this was during Omicron, the trial was conducted, what's called the vaccine effectiveness was lower than what people thought. It was 37% and 44%, depending on if you stratified by 6 months to 2 years and then 2 years to 6 years. But those antibodies, because we just talked about the immune system, heralds that there was probably creation of cellular immunity, because actually, if you're going to make antibodies, you're likely to make T and B cells. And so even though the protection wasn't amazing against mild disease, not as good as we thought, and there was no severe disease in the population, either in the placebo group or the vaccine group, because children are much less at risk for severe disease, I still think it was a success to show that antibodies were up where they needed to be. And personally, if I had a child under six, I would get them vaccinated. But It's for parents, they're weighing the pros and cons of this. Again, very safe, which I think was a huge outcome of the trial. 4,200 participants, no myocarditis, no problems with the children. And it was, I've called it a middling success. Let's call it that way.
Middling success on effectiveness, zero side effects. Last question.
And very good antibody titers. And I think that's important.
Along with the rollbacks of various mandates, it may seem like a mixed message. Various places are distributing N95 or KN95 masks for those who want to use them. Do you have numbers on N95 effectiveness? Like, if I'm exposed to a COVID infectious person for the same amount of time with an N95 versus unmasked, everything else being equal, is there a number you can put on my risk reduction?
Well, kind of, based on physical science studies. So one-way masking works, which is why I think that mask recommendations are not dropping for anyone who wants very little exposure to a respiratory pathogen. And at least by physical science studies, an N95, if you're wearing it properly, fit tested, that 95 really does mean it's supposed to block 95% of viral particles. Probably with taking off and on, it's going to go down with effectiveness. In general, KN95s, FFP2s, KF94s, N95s, and double masks block viral particles from coming in variably between 80 and 95%. Again, in physical science studies, which I really think do reflect what's happening to us as an individual. So that one-way protection really does work, I think. And I have an older immunocompromised father who's simply not going out in the public indoors without one of these strong masks.
Dr. Monica Gandhi, MD and with a master's in public health, an infectious diseases specialist and professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. San Francisco, like New York, has been a national leader in policies to fight COVID throughout the pandemic. So we really appreciate your bi-coastal view. And since it's only 7:40 in the morning there, thank you again for doing this yeoman's early call. Now you can have breakfast.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.